seated, please. Court is ready to hear argument in 060243, Solar Applications Engineering, Inc. versus TA Operating Corporation.
May it please the court, Mr. Alexander will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Court to reverse the judgment of the Court of Appeals and render the same judgment that the trial court did for two independent reasons. First, because a general contractor and its subcontractors should not be required to give up their security for payment in order to pursue a claim for nonpayment. And thus, the Court of Appeals reversibly erred when it held that as a condition precedent for bringing a suit for substantial performance against an owner who is refusing to pay any portion of the retainage, that the general contractor was not only required to give up its statutorily guaranteed lien rights, it was also required to prevail on its subcontractors to give up their lien rights. The second reason for reversal is that under a proper reading of the contract, it is evident that the condition precedent that was relied upon by the Court of Appeals, that is the lien release provision in the contract, was never triggered because the contract was terminated before the time for that performance ever arose. The net result in this case was a manifest injustice. We have a situation in which the general contractor and its subcontractors completed 99.8% of the work under the contract, but the general contractor was held to have forfeited $392,000, almost 10% of the contract price. What should have instead happened in this case was for the Court of Appeals to leave undisturbed what the trial court did. That is to first have a trial about who owed who what, and then at the end of the day have a second proceeding in which the lien claims were resolved so that at the end of the day the proper party could go away with their money and the owner could go away with a lien-free building.
So would there been, how would this case have been different if you had turned over the lens that they wanted? You still would have had the jury trial, you still would have won, and you wouldn't have had to be here because that it just, you just would be out collecting your judgment today.
Well, collecting judgment on what? That's the problem. In other words, the purpose, the very purpose of the lien is a guarantee to collect the money at the end of the day. And it's a guarantee not only to the general contractor, but also to the subcontractor. So that would be the problem. We would have given up that guarantee of payment.
Are they bankrupt or something?
Well, who knows?
Well, but I mean, for instance, on letters of credit. Letter of credit is an agreement of who gets to hold the money while we fight. And isn't this just an agreement as to whether there's a lien on the property or not while we fight? As soon as you win, you can slap a lien back on the property.
Well, so one would say, but what we were being asked to tender was a release of lien. So, no, I don't agree with that last supposition, that at the end of the day we could slap a lien.
Mechanic and materials lien. Once you win the judgment, you've got a judgment lien. You filed a judgment lien, you got a new lien. You didn't release a judgment lien.
Yes, but
isn't this just an agreement as to whether we're having a lien on the property while we have the lawsuit? And your clients agreed that there wouldn't be a lien on the property while we had the lawsuit.
Well, we did not agree that there would not be a lien on the property while we pursued the lawsuit, and that's point one. Point two is that you really need to look at what a statutory lien is. It's wanted. If you actually look at the provisions of the lien statutes, particularly the one about preference over other creditors, all subcontractors, laborers, and material men who have a mechanics lien have preference over other creditors of the original contractor. It's a super lien. It's one that has been in existence not only constitutionally guaranteed but also provided. So the business of saying we'd have a judgment lien or some other type of lien doesn't cut it, because what you've given up is the most highest regarded lien that exists in the construction context.
But you would have turned them over if they had paid you the check, been willing to give you the check.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, that's what's contemplated under the Lynn statutes. I did one of my little cheat sheets here that kind of lays out how it works. The way that the contract contemplates that things are going to work, if things work out in a peaceable fashion, is that you complete the work. Well, actually, the first thing you do is that you substantially complete the work. And that's the first grid here. That's paragraph 14.04. What happens there is, once you've substantially completed, the building is ready for its intended use. I mean, in this case, Popeyes is up and running, and you've got Country Pride. You can take the family out to dinner down there. Everything is ready to go. The next thing that happens, though, is that as part of that, the owner provides a punch list, saying, okay, it's substantially complete, but it's not entirely complete. Here's the list of items, and that's what happened here. And then the parties worked along towards completing those punch list items, but at the point in which the project was 99.8% complete, TA terminated the contract per cause, they said. That was before the entire work was complete. And the way it works is this. It's in peaceable circumstances where you don't boot somebody off the job. You complete the entire work, at which point there's a final inspection. And at the final inspection, everybody gets together and go, okay, are we all comfortable? Everything's done. It's all through. All good? Well, then let's get together. It's kind of like settling up in a lawsuit. Let's all get together around the big table, and I'll tell you what, we'll just pass items here. Subcontractors, well, first, general contractor, here's your check. You're cutting your checks to the subcontractors, and here's all the releases of liens, every one of them. Let's walk away from the table. Owner, you've got a lien-free building. General contractor, you've got your money. Subs, you've got your money. That's the way it's supposed to play out. Now, what happened here was the parties got into a dispute.
But the way the language reads, before everyone walks away, your final application for payment is supposed to be accompanied by these release of liens, right? So are you saying that you made a mistake in signing it, you shouldn't have signed it, or the language is ineffective, or is not a condition?
No, and first off, let's talk about that. Once again, that language, 14.07, about, we tender the liens, occurs after the final inspection has occurred, occurs after the work is entirely complete, which never occurred here. Now, the way it's written and the way it works in real practice, I don't want to get too hung up on that. Generally speaking,
What was the dispute?
The dispute was this. We said, we've done most of the work here, and we're entitled to be paid. 99.8% complete. The other side says, oh, no. Your subcontractor screwed up. Defective work. What you need to look at is Defendant's Exhibit 11 and 12. Those are the key exhibits. Those are what lays out the position of the owner. And what the owner's saying is this work was so bad that we're entitled to recover $750,000. And that's what the lawsuit was about. They want to come up here and say that, ooh, really the reason that we weren't paying over this money was because of these, these outstanding liens. But look at Defendant's Exhibits 11 and 12. And what you will see there is the lien business, at least in the opening letter of the, giving notice of default, is item number 4. And item number 1 is, look at all this defective work, and we'll tell you how much that costs later. That was on October 18th. On November 13th, when the notice of termination went out, it says, attached is a full schedule of everything's defective. And look, if you add it up, it's $736,000. So that's what the lawsuit was about. That's why they went tooth and tongue. And at the end of the day, the jury said, well, no. No to the owner. Yes to the general contractor. The general contractor, you did 99.8% of your work. You were about $8,000 short. So at the end of the day, the court properly entered judgment for $392,000, which was the $400,000 retainage less the $8,000 of work that needed to be done.
Just to go back for a second,
yes.
Back to the language, I'm trying to understand, and it seemed like the amicus doesn't answer this question for me either. This language says when you make, and let's assume the timing is okay here.
Okay.
When you make your final application for payment, you must accompany it with all these legally effective releases or waivers of all lien rights.
Okay.
So you're making this waiver before before you get the final payment, even. Is that
right? And that's the way it's set up, and I don't have a problem with that.
Okay, if you don't have a problem, then why?
I don't have a problem, and I'll explain why. Because This comes up again. Once again, you're doing this after everybody has gotten together. They've done their final inspection. Everybody goes, everybody cool? Is it all good? It's all done? Yep. Good. I'm trusting you, I, general contractor, and going to my people and say they're ready to pay. So here's, give me your liens. Okay. Here's our liens. We bundle them up, give them to you in an envelope with our final application for payment, which here, again, was never reached, but you turn that over. And then what happens is that the owner is to, you know, and this is also under 14.07, looks it all over and says, you know, this all looks good to me. We'll go ahead and pay. Or the owner goes, still not quite right. Still not quite right.
Why can't the subcontractors and the general tender all this stuff conditioned on payment being made as follows? Well, yes, here's our release of lien, but it's not any good unless we get our last $50,000.
And are you talking about
a sort of escrow or a conditional tender? I mean, you rather than go through all these machinations, look like this is going to arise a lot, and what you would just say is, sure, I'll give you a release of lien, but it's no good. I want you to, we'll have an agreement, but it's no good unless I get my last $50,000.
Well, and this is before the tooth and tongue lawsuit.
Yeah.
Conceptually, and I haven't thought about it, so, you know, I may be making a concession here that I'll regret later and we'll write you a letter, but conceptually, I don't have a problem with that. I don't. I mean, in other words, if it's a matter of saying, and the problem here, though, is an unconditional release. But what you're talking about, that doesn't bother me. You know, look, if at the end of the day, you know, you're right, we're wrong, you don't pay us any money, you get your lien releases, we'll have somebody third party hold that as an escrow. Conceptually, I don't have a problem with that because it gets us to the same place. We have not unqualifiedly given up our lien rights at a time when they're required most. Don't have a problem with it.
But under paragraph 7, and going to that, doesn't it also, the contract appears to say that you could simply bond around that and provide a bond to the owner in lieu of that, so that to fix that failure of a sub to give you a release of lien.
Yeah, and I'll confess to you, Justice Johnson, I'm not as familiar with the bonding requirement.
Right.
I'm not. But I think that that is perhaps to deal with a situation where you have the recalcitrant sub.
Right.
Now, everybody else says, you know, I'm tendering up. The one sub says, the general contractor goes, look, we'll just bond around that. So, I mean, I think it's intended to deal with that situation, but it doesn't cure the concern of the Court of Appeals decision.
Right, it does. I agree with that, but I mean, there are a lot of different ways you could have done it. The problem is none of them happened in this case.
None of them happened in this case. And what happened was, I mean, we went through a whole lawsuit, and we got a judgment. We went up in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals initially said affirmed. And then on rehearing, suddenly it's like, well, geez, because you didn't 3 years ago unqualifiedly give up your lien rights when you needed most, you failed to satisfy a condition precedent, and therefore you don't collect. And what we say is that that was erroneous. And establishes harmful precedent not only for general contractors, but also for subcontractors. I think I've got a couple minutes. I'm going to anticipate an argument that's going to be made on the other side. And that is that I think yesterday you got a fax of a recent statute that went into effect September 1. And I've got this under tab 2 of my cheat sheet here. And that's dealing with contingent payment provisions. In our briefing, we talk about how some contracts, or most actually, contracts between general contractors and their subs have so-called contingent payment provisions, which means that if I don't get paid, you don't pay, period. What this statute does is it ameliorates that provision in certain situations, but it doesn't cure the Court of Appeals problem here because of the italicized language. And I have here, a general contractor or a surety may not enforce a contingent payment clause to the extent that the owner's nonpayment to the general contractor is the result of the contractual obligations of the general contractor not being met. So in other words, if there's a default by the general contractor, so far, so good. You can't enforce a contingent payment provision against a subcontractor. But here's the key language. Unless the nonpayment is the result of the subcontractor's failure to meet the general contractor's contractual requirements. And so what you have here is, if you look again at Defendant's Exhibit 11 and 12, that's what that is. That is the obligor under the statute. The owner saying the sub's performance is subpar. And in that situation, the sub's don't get the benefit of this statute. They're still stuck. They don't get paid until the general contractor gets paid, and therefore they're very concerned about a decision that says, well, geez, before, you know, if we're going to sue this owner who we're saying, you know, is improperly claiming that your work is defective, first off, you have to bundle up these liens. Don't do it in escrow. Give it over unqualifiedly and wait, you know, release your liens. We say that that's improper. Yes.
As I understand the bulk of your argument, first several pages of your brief, you say that even assuming that this the obligation to provide releases is a condition precedent, you believe you win for two reasons. One, the requirement was never triggered. You never reached that stage
right.
in the transaction. And two, as I understand it, that a condition precedent like this, your argument is only goes to the payment. It doesn't preclude a filing of suit to
right.
enforce your obligation, your
That's
right
correct.
To get paid, as you understand. Does the contingent payment clause, does that have, is that affected at all by release of liens? That is, the clause that says the general contractor only has to pay the subs if and when the owner pays the general, is that affected by the releases?
And let me make sure I understand it. In other words, if we had released, would that have been affected, or
under the structure of this?
Well, actually, I mean the way it works, I think that the answer is no. For this reason, it's still the contingent payment clause is one that says that until the general contractor gets its money, it has no obligation to pay money to the subcontractor. And if you have a situation in which the general contractor is never paid by the owner for whatever reason, under a pure contingent payment provision, the subs don't get paid. The statute that I've been talking about helps to deal with this situation. The harshness.
Let me ask a question.
Okay.
Probably more succinctly this
okay.
way: if the general contractor had provided the release of liens
before bringing suit,
then how would the subs get paid? What right would they be able to follow? What recourse to get paid?
Would they
be able to go against the owner?
No, they'd be out of luck. I mean, that's the problem. That's the concern, is that the only privity of contract is between the owner and the general contractor. There is no contractual relationship between the owner and the subs. And so in a very real way, the subs rely upon the general contractor to pursue a suit against the general against the owner. And if they give up their lien rights, let's go back. If they don't give up their lien rights, then they do have a claim against the property ultimately if the owner doesn't pay.
Right.
That's the value to them of the liens, and that's why they're concerned about having to give up lien rights. That's what gives them a recovery. If they give up their liens, then they're completely out of luck because they don't have a claim against the general contractor because there's been no payment, and they don't have a claim against the owner because or the building because the lien right has been X'd out. I see I'm out of time.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Calloway will present argument for the respondent.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. If I can start with Justice Wainwright's question, I believe the answer to your question was what happens in this. I assume you were referring to the 35.521 contingency pay statute that I had provided the court with yesterday. And the only reason I did that was to demonstrate yet again that the legislature has a very comprehensive scheme worked out for this whole situation, and it's called mechanics lien. And as I understood Solar's response to your question was, if they don't get to enforce that contingency pay or to not enforce that contingency pay, then they're out of luck. They're never out of luck because the sub has a mechanics lien. The general can't waive the sub's lien for him, and the owner can't make the sub waive his lien. He's got that lien.
But your client was requiring
the release of liens as a condition to being paid. And as I understand your argument here is that Solar doesn't have the right to pursue the lawsuit without releasing the liens either.
No, Your Honor, that's not our position.
That's not our position at all. That's the way it's characterized.
That's the way it was characterized, but it's not our position. Our position is that the doctrine of substantial performance does give the contractor a right to pursue the contract, but it is a suit on the contract. And on the contract are very important words. It's not, substantial performance is not an independent cause of action. It doesn't mean that you get to ignore the contract. It's all it is really is to say you have a right to sue on the contract. It avoids the harsh rule of prior material breach, allows you to sue on the contract, but suing on the contract means just that. You come to court, you sue on the contract, and the court has to apply the contract to the argument you're making and the recovery you're asking for.
And how did the court not do that here? By severing out the subcontractor claims and saying out of any recovery we're going to pay them, why doesn't that take care of what the contract was designed to do?
Well, procedurally, Your Honor, it doesn't work. That order, the court is making an order before the case is tried on the subs arguments. Procedurally, the sub should never have been severed out. And TA operating argued against them being severed out for this very reason. All of this should have been determined in a dispute, and we wouldn't be standing here today because the condition precedent wouldn't have worked because they wouldn't have reached judgment without deciding the subs. And so that order that talks about what has to happen.
This trial didn't decide whether the subs work was defective?
No, it did not, Your Honor, because Solar expressly moved to sever them out.
Well, I understand that, and it didn't grant recovery to the subs, but surely you defended the case saying the stuff we got was no good.
Yes, we did.
So this case did decide whether the work was defective or not.
It did in terms of the yes, and it decided that we were wrong. The jury found $88,000 in delay damages, but those were held to be waived, and so we recovered nothing on that.
So there's no longer a barrier then to the subs coming in and satisfying their liens. I mean, that gets back to my original question: is why is the way that the court handled this not? Why doesn't that further the purpose of the contract?
Because the court that issue wasn't before the court. It's really an advisory sort of opinion that here's what's going to happen when we get over to this case.
What's wrong with that? I mean, what's
left? I don't think a court can do that. I think procedurally you've got to have the issues before you. And what they did is they decided to sue on the contract, keep in mind this is a contract only between the owner and the general. It doesn't concern the sub's rights at all. It's whether the owner has to pay or not. And there was a condition precedent saying we don't have to pay the final payment, which here constituted really the retainage, which we were statutorily required to retain.
Well, I still don't understand, because after the trial, you now have to pay, and you know what you have to pay. So what do you care about what happens with the subs? I mean, what's going to happen in the severed suit? They'll pay whatever they think's due on the lien. So where's the beef for you in the severed suit?
I don't care that it was severed. It would have been better to have all the liens, everything decided in one judgment. And by the way, Solar had its own lien, but it abandoned that lien. It sued for foreclosure on the lien, and remember, it won at the trial court. It was entitled to judgment, and was entitled to judgment both on the recovery for substantial performance and on its lien. It did not ask for any judgment. There's a Mother Hubbard clause, and therefore its lien is gone. Specifically in this case, its lien is gone, and it's asking this court to, in effect, make some sort of advisory opinion on that issue.
But that's your only problem then with the way the court handled it, is it's now advisory, although that doesn't affect you anymore.
Right, exactly. And I don't have a problem with that. Our position is our condition precedent required releases of liens, that there couldn't be liens on our property, and if there were liens on our property, we were not contractually obligated.
Your client sent a letter terminating the contract before that point was reached. Y'all were still working on the punch list. The punch list has to be completed at least to the satisfaction of the parties before you get a final application for payment. Before the punch list was completed, you sent a letter saying the contract is terminated. So how are they supposed to then proceed in performance of the contract? And this is a question I'm kind of wrestling with, if your client had declared it terminated before that point.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, the termination does not terminate the contract. The contract is still in place. What it does is terminate
Solo's. It's still in place to the extent that you're going to fight over it and see who gets damages.
Exactly. But it doesn't.
But when you terminate it, surely you didn't expect that you both would proceed following the terms of the contract as if no termination letter had been sent.
We terminated their right to proceed with the work. And when we terminated, we specifically said, we are terminating this contract because you are in violation of the contract. There was in addition to this all bills paid condition precedent, there was a separate and independent provision in the contract, 6.20C, that required Solar to keep the project lien free. And we said at that point we had three liens on the project. And we said there are liens on our project, you have breached the contract, and we're going to terminate your right to proceed.
But if they had tendered releases of liens, you wouldn't have paid them anyway.
We would have still, but those are two different things. Because we had
you're saying
dispute.
This is a condition, but if you'd have gotten it, you weren't going to pay them, and everybody knew that.
That's true, but why are we not entitled to stand on our contract? Because there are two separate issues here. There's the condition precedent to final payment, and there's the dispute about the defective work.
Because there's anticipatory repudiation. You can't stand there and say, I'll act, but you got to do this first, if we all know that I'm not going to do it regardless of whether you act. That's no longer a condition of my payment because fulfilling it isn't going to make anything happen. How is that still a condition?
Well, it is a condition because that was a risk. A risk was that we would have liens put on our property, and that's still a very real risk to us, and we shifted that risk just as the statute does. The statute always and consistently places the duty, and that's what gets lost in this whole argument. The duty is always on the general contractor to pay the subs, not on the owner. It's always on the general, and that's what that new legislation reemphasizes. The general has to pay the
subs. So, counsel, is your position that you're entitled to a release of liens, but you shouldn't have to pay the $392,000?
No, my position is, had they provided releases of liens, and Justice Johnson's right, they could have bonded around it, and Justice Hecht is right.
But none of that are in the facts of this case. None of that's in the facts of this case. Bonding around it or other things, and you're right, they're in the contract. But, I mean, let's deal with what's on our plate. You seem to be saying you're entitled to the release of liens without, but have no obligation to pay the $392,000. See, what's both sides to kind of seem to have a kind of old Western standoff, a six-shooter pointed at each other. Give me the release of liens, you give me the payment, give me one at the same time I get the other. And you seem to be claiming you're entitled, well, you do argue you're entitled to the release of liens, but do you also have the obligation to pay the contract price? Or do you think you can get one without paying the contract price?
Let me answer it this way. What this condition precedent did was bar their recovery in a suit on the contract. And whether we got the fact of the matter is we didn't get the releases, and that's why we're relying on that condition precedent. And that's the point we're at. And it is in the case whether they could have bonded, and 53.85C1 specifically addresses what Justice Heck brought up, is that they could have conditioned their waiver of a lien.
Okay. In the final outcome, if you get a $392,000 judgment, should the final result incorporate that you also get release of liens? Or you actually pay the $392,000. You should get release of liens.
That's outside the record, Your Honor, but I understand the liens have been paid. And so that's no longer at issue. But the point is, when they sued on the contract, a verdict was reached on that suit on the contract, and a judgment was entered, those liens were outstanding. and therefore, under the contract, we had no duty to pay. And that's what the question's about. It's not whether we got the releases, but the question here is, did we have a duty to pay? And under the contract, we don't have a duty to pay.
Isn't part of the issue here a timing problem? Certainly, if both parties went all the way through final application and payment, then all the steps that are required to be taken after the punch list is done would be required by both sides. But the question here seems to back that timetable up a little bit and ask, what happens if a breach of the contract is declared and there's litigation before the punch list stage is finished and you get the final application for payment? Isn't that what we're talking about?
I don't think it's what we're talking about. I think the end question is, do we have a duty to pay under the contract? And the answer is no. But part of the answer to your question would be, the contract at 15.02C specifically provides that termination of the agreement, i.e. terminating before we get to final inspection, does not affect the owner's rights. And this whole peaceable argument is a remarkable one to me, because it contemplates that if it goes along peaceably, then, in fact, the brief says, if it goes along peaceably, then that condition precedent makes sense. But if it doesn't, then you shouldn't enforce that condition precedent. And where on earth is there any authority for you construe a contract differently depending on whether it's peaceable or not? In fact, if it had gone peaceably, you never get to a court, so there's no reason for such a rule. And that's the whole point of contracting. You're shifting risk, and one of the risks you shift is the very risk that came to pass. And you shift it, and you say, if things go wrong. And so you can't ignore this risk shifting when things do go wrong, and they've gone wrong. The contract didn't get completely finished. But does that mean, because it didn't proceed exactly as it should, that they should never be finally paid?
Well,
I don't think that's what it means.
If we accepted your position, tell me what the result is. The result is you don't have to pay the $390,000 judgment.
Correct.
The contractor had to pay the liens off.
Correct.
Even though everybody acknowledges 380-something thousand worth of work was done. So the owner gets a windfall. Just as a practical matter.
It may be a practical matter, but that's precisely what the statute contemplates.
A windfall.
Is it a windfall? They didn't procedurally file. They didn't prove up their contract. They didn't keep their lien in place.
If the liens were still in place, if they had not paid off the liens, then and we were to hold that it was a condition precedent, then the materialman can pay off the lien. I mean, then they can pursue foreclosure of those liens, and you will be responsible.
But what this all assumes is that this court can come in and rewrite this contract. As the Court of Appeals noted, parties are free to contract, even if it's a stupid contract. The court doesn't get to rewrite it. This court can void a contract as against public policy. That doesn't mean we don't like it. There's a windfall involved here the way you contracted. And as Justice Heck noted in the Criswell opinion, you don't construe unambiguous contracts, and there's nothing ambiguous about 1407.
But this is why we try to do our bend over backwards, in fact, to avoid finding something to be a condition and say it's a covenant. Say, okay, if they breached it by putting on a lease, that's fine. They'll have to pay you all the damages you've incurred from having a lien on your property, which is nothing. But then you've got to do your side of the contract. What's wrong with that traditional
rule? I disagree with you, Your Honor, that this court gets to bend over backwards to construe conditions preceding as covenants. If the intent is doubtful, then the court starts to construe. As I was saying, as Justice Heck pointed out, you don't construe unambiguous contracts. Here, there was never an argument made below that 1407, the condition precedent, was ambiguous. It wasn't submitted. It wasn't argued, and it wasn't submitted to the jury. And Solar has therefore waived that argument.
But Criswell, in cases before it, say you've got to have some kind of conditional language in there. It can't just be party A agrees to do 1, 2, and 3, and party B agrees to do 1, 2, and 3, and you didn't do 1, so that's a condition. That's not the law. Those are bargain promises. They're covenant. The condition is something that if you don't do two, we get to get everything. You owe nothing, and everything goes away. And there's nothing language like that in this contract.
And that's what 1407B says. If you don't submit your final payment in accordance with the contract, we're not going to pay it. That's the if. And 53.085 specifically recognizes this very condition and says, owners, you can do that. And the reason they do is they've allowed a lien to be placed on the owner's property by someone who's not in privity with them. And so they give the owner, it's a delicate balance between owners, general contractors, and subs. And what they do is they give the owner this protection against double liability, paying the general and the general not paying the subs.
And if that's the rule, then really owners have a strong incentive to go find a friendly subcontractor to file a lien. Seems like I've got a serious problem with collusion. If I can go get the drywall guy to file a little lien on this, I can get out of a $3 million contract and have me a free gas station. That can't be what the parties intended, is it?
Well, it's not the party's intent. It's the legislature's intent. And they've set up this scheme, and I'm sure there are people who do abuse it, but that's not the situation here. It's not an abuse situation. It's a straight-up condition precedent. We bargained for that risk. Solar promised that it would keep it, promised separately that it would keep it lien-free, and it didn't live up to that promise, and that's what we're saying. We therefore don't have a duty to pay under the contract. And
if it weren't a condition preceding, and the general sued the owner for payment and won something, would the owner be entitled in that judgment to have any existing liens set aside before having to pay it? Do you think you would have that argument with the court? I guess you couldn't make that argument if the subcontractors weren't there.
Right. And I can't.
And their claims might be more than what the general recovered in the lawsuit.
Yeah. As I said, the statutory scheme lays it out. It keeps placing the burden on the general to pay. And that's what this case is about. And that's what. The general hasn't explained why it didn't pay the subs. As a matter of fact, at the third volume of the record, pages 141 to 42, Bob Romer, who's the Solar officer in charge of overseeing this project, is asked, well, did you not pay the subs because we hadn't given you the final payment? And he says, no, that's not the case. In other words, they had the money to pay the subs. They just decided we're not going to pay the subs until you finally pay us. And nowhere in this statutory scheme is it provided that the owner has to finally pay before. In fact, to the contrary, it recognizes the right to this all bills paid, and it is a part of the balance. And I guess my main point is this court can't rewrite the contract. And when I coming back to Justice Brister's question, you don't get to ignore a condition precedent unless the language is doubtful and unless there is another reasonable interpretation under the contract. And the 14.04 substantial completion and the 14.06 final inspection have nothing to do with final payment. Yes, there's steps in the contracting process and the building process, but they have nothing to do with final payment. 1407 is the only one that... My time's up. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Okay, please, the court. I have 5 minutes, and in that time, I intended to address a question raised by Justice Wainwright, one raised by Justice Brister, another by Justice O'Neill, and do housekeeping tasks, subject, of course, to being interrupted at any time by your questions. First, Justice Wainwright, It is a timing issue in terms of interpreting the contract. We are not asking this court to ignore the contract or to rewrite the contract. What we've laid out on that tab under number one is that this contract was terminated before the time for performance arrived. Justice Brister, you're correct. What they were asking us to do by tendering releases would have been a pointless act. We would have tendered all these releases, given up all the lien rights, and they still would not have paid because their claim was quite clearly, and in fact, if you look at Defendant's Exhibit 11, you'll see the word offset. Their whole claim was, we have a claim for $750,000. You've got a claim for, you know, $400,000 retainage. It's going to be an offset. So it would have been a pointless act. Justice O'Neill, you had asked why wouldn't the severance have taken care of the concern. It would have. The severance would have taken care of the concern, and I think it would have taken care of the concern. That is, the concern being the double liability problem. I don't want to stand up here and say that there aren't legitimate interests at stake here, including the interest of the owner to walk away at the end of the day, having paid off all the money with a lien-free building. That's what the severance was intended to do. And back to, I think you asked a related question on that, Justice Acton, and I've now lost it, but I think
Solar
that
had only recovered $10,000.
Say what?
Solar had only recovered $10,000 instead of $392 or whatever it was, and the lien claim, the subcontractors still all had their lien claims. The result would be that the owner would have to pay Solar the $10,000 or whatever, and then still have to litigate the lien claims.
No, actually, I mean, the good point, but no, for this reason, the $10,000 would be is saying that general contractor, you and your subs only performed, you know, what would that be, 2.5% of the final work, or you know, and so at that point. No, the subs would not have any claims again, over
binding.
And above
Why
that.
Why would that be binding on the subs? They weren't there. It wouldn't be res judicata. They could still make their claim.
Well, and as a matter of fact, in this case, I mean, they intervened. I mean, that was the you raise an interesting question there as well. But I think that the I think that in terms of the lien claims, yes, they would be out of luck in that situation because the general contractor, again, is the only one that's actually in privity with the owner, and so it's the general contractor who's pursuing the claims not only on its own behalf but also on behalf of the subs because it's really the subs who did the work. I mean, this is a case in which, you know, 99% of the work, for whatever it was actually performed by the subs.
Well, if there are 20 subcontractors and
yeah.
One of them says, well, I – whatever the other 19 did, I did mine.
Right.
And the general contractor only recovered a fraction of what he thought was due on the project, but I'm due what I put on the property, which, say, make it easy, was all equipment, so it's just sitting there. So he still has a claim against the owner.
Well, actually, at that point, and maybe this now I finally figured it out. Sorry it took me so long, but really the claim would be against the general contractor.
Well, but he still has a lien, though.
He still has a lien, but in that situation, and this is why you'd have the separate action. I mean, this gets back to your point. You may have a situation where, you know, the sub who says, look, I did all the work, and really the only reason you got $10,000 is either you screwed up prosecuting the lawsuit, or really it was because of your delayed general contractor in the critical path method. That's what caused everything, so I want my money. I want my money. And in that situation, what would happen in the second lawsuit would be they would adjudicate, you know, that would be decided. And it may be decided, okay, General, you pay off this person, but at the end of the day, General, you're not getting a dime until everybody's paid off. And at the end of the day, we're going to get this thing resolved in a way so that the owner walks away with a lien-free building. So that's how that would be resolved.
You would say in that situation that the general contractor shouldn't get the judgment, whatever it was, $10,000, some lesser amount, if there were still all these lien claims out there, because that would deprive the owner of his contract altogether. He would be making payment to the general, and he'd still be facing all these lien claims.
Well, what I'm saying is in that situation, and this is why we have the severed action, I agree that at the end of the day, he should be able to walk away. And that's what we would be litigated in that claim. Again, it could be a situation where it could come out different ways. it could be adjudicated there that, well, sub, you say you did all the work, but you didn't. So you're not going to get, you know, all of your lien claim. I'm sorry. Or it could be it really did fall on the general contractor. But that's where you sort that all out. And at the end of the day, the idea is, as in any situation, everybody walks away, some happier than others. But in the long run, the subs are addressed, the general contractor addressed, and, these, and the owner addressed, because they're all involved in that suit.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The clause is submitted, and that concludes the argument for this morning. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, now stands adjourned.